All right, so we have a lot of questions. Tell you right now, we won't get to them all, but they're all very, very good. And so that's where the information on the contact sheet will come in handy, hopefully. We have tried to group some of them under the similar topics. I'm going to start with some basic ones, and the way we talked about doing this before is if someone had a some of these are addressed to specific people, and if someone wants to respond after that person answers, or if there's a little discussion that needs to happen, we'll just kind of roll with it. But we will try to keep it to one or two of you answering the question, whoever thinks this should be deferred to, or if we think that there should be someone to answer it specifically. The first one, I don't know who is the best person, probably state or BLM, but what qualifies as a large mine? And if you want to just say your name before you take the question, since we are recording for radio so they know who's talking.
Okay, I'll answer that. Kyle Mozell, Alaska Department of Natural Resources. Large mine, I think that's more of a state term. Large can be, it's basically anything beyond that Alaska, the APMA, Alaska permit to mine in Alaska application. So anything beyond 5 acres, we regulate it as a large mine. It has to be a load mine. So we're talking about a load mine, locatable minerals, more than 5 acres disturbance. You need a discharge authorization or a waste management permit. That's usually, for us, what kicks it into large mine status.
Okay. And maybe just this came up as a question for me. If you're, that's talking in a mining process, not necessarily an exploration process. And is there a difference in an exploration process before you move to a mine about large or small scale or anything like that?
I don't know of any exploration activities that have gone beyond 5 acres disturbance.
And if one does, do you have rules and regulations for that, I guess?
I can answer that. Yeah. So if you have an exploration project that pushes beyond that 5 acres, or under BLM regulations, that 1,000-ton bulk sample, then they're pushed into a plan. Just because it's a plan doesn't mean that they're actually developing the resource for mining. They're still doing exploration. It just means that the footprint of that exploration project is pushed into the realm of needing NEPA analysis. It needs further analysis in its process. So the 5 acre limitation for exploration is to focus for on the ground small projects to define a resource, but then eventually that project may grow to a size that they need to delineate it further. It's going to get a bigger footprint. That's when you start looking at cumulative impacts, those kind of things.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else?
I guess I should clarify too. That's a qualitative term. It's not a regulatory term. Large mine. It's a colloquialism, if you will.
Okay, I understand. So not a regulatory term. Okay.
Yeah.
For Guy Archibald, again, we're just going through some real general questions, real quick. Do you believe that any mine can be operated without significant effect on fish habitat?
Well, then you get into the definition of significant. Sure, there's lots of large mines where there is no fish habitat to start with. I can't think of an example of a mine that has not produced some surface or groundwater quality impacts. How they impact the fishery, it's tough to gauge. I'm sorry if I sound like I'm waffling here a little bit, but some of the effects can be multi-generational, effects that you won't see for generations down the road. It's also hard, given all the natural variation in fisheries, to kind of pick the signal out of the noise of all the other variations. But that's about as best as I can answer it. It's tough to answer.
Okay, thanks, Guy. I think Bob wanted a crack at it, too.
I think you said some things that I disagree with. I think you told people that Greens Creek has really sort of destroyed Greens Creek, but that it was okay because it was not significant. That was the implication I got. And I think it's important to tell people that I don't think that happened. That here's what Fish and Game does. And if I misquote characterizing what you said, my apologies. But that's kind of what I think you said.
Well, maybe I misspoke. It was okay. The creek in question was Tributary Creek. It was subject to the expansion of the tailings pile. And the company's preferred alternative was to dump all those tailings into that creek. And there was nothing about the process that would have prevented that.
But they didn't give the permit for that, did they?
They didn't as yet. The Forest Service waffled, gave them a 10-year, but that was for other reasons.
I do think it's important to talk about effect on fish habitat. And here is what how fish and game monitors protect on fish habitat. They look upstream and downstream, and they typically monitor, they certainly monitor the water quality and the groundwater and the surface water. That's usually DEC's responsibility. But then they monitor the algae in three levels. They monitor it from the benthic environment from algae to the mid-level things, and then the bugs that they eat. And then they look at whether the fish, they look at population, habitat, and then they sort of take the young, because the young will be more susceptible to metals, and they look at whether they've accumulated any metals. They basically take the smolts and they put them into a lab quality blender and they blend them up and extract metals to see whether, in fact, there is any. So they look to see if there's any effect on the algae, the benthic environment, fish populations, metal uptake. And I think it's important to say that in Greens Creek, they haven't seen any. It's also important that throughout our large mines, now I'm not suggesting that there isn't risk and there aren't things that have, but it's important to note that they haven't seen any at Pogo. They haven't seen any. Fort Knox has actually improved because it was trashed habitat before from like the 1902 mining. But Fort Knox has improved. Pogo, they haven't seen any. Greens Creek, they haven't seen any. They haven't seen any out in Hawk Inlet. Red Dog is...
And these are fish and game statistics? Or
yes, okay. Mostly. Mostly fish and game statistics. In some cases, fish and game oversees them, but they're mostly fish and game statistics and DEC and company water quality, usually. And at Red Dog, what they found, Red Dog was acid before the mine got there. That's how they found the mine. So Red Dog, the statistics show improved habitat, improved health of the fish. Now, it's important to note that the people downstream, far downstream, dispute some of that.
David,
But I think Alaska's large mines have actually a pretty good record with respect to fish habitat. Now, mind you, we're a modern large mines. We don't have a lot of the legacy issues.
Okay, Bob. David, did you have a point you wanted to make on that?
Yeah, I do. I guess I'd like to add a couple postscripts. So I don't disagree that overall I think Alaska's large mines are doing fairly well, but at Red Dog there was a significant fish kill back in 1990. They killed fish that all the way from the mine down to the Woolock River. And at Greens Creek... During the last permit cycle, I made some suggestions about how to monitor the mixing zone that I thought would be more appropriate. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, those of you who may be more familiar with Greens Creek than my memory is at the moment, but they're taking one surface water measurement a quarter in the mixing zone, and that measurement point isn't even in the mixing zone. So I said, why don't you put it at the edge of the theoretical mixing zone, and why don't you measure it at a slack tide instead of just some arbitrary time? So I agree, Bob. I don't think there's been any significant damage to Red Dog, to Greens Creek, but I don't think we know about the mixing zone. I don't think the measurement there is good enough to tell.
Okay, one more point, Bob.
No, let's
okay. What I was going to say is I guess this points out where there's a difference in the value of significant, perhaps, in some of the wording. So, I mean, I'm just saying that there's different opinions on just this one.
I think there's different technical opinions.
Technical opinions.
I don't
opinions.
Think it's a difference in the value of significant.
Okay.
I do think the resources there are significant. I don't think degradation would be significant.
Okay. Guy, do you want to wrap it up since this question was directed to you at the first?
Yeah, just very quickly, the discharge from the Greens Creek isn't a Hawk Inlet. And as of yet, The Department of Environmental Conservation categorizes Hawk Inlet as a Category 3 water body, which by definition means you don't have enough data to determine whether or not the designated use, which is aquatic life and habitat, is being protected.
You need to, since I was there when DEC said they disagree with that interpretation, you need to tell them their, you need to tell them the interpretation they gave you. It's not fair to give just one side.
Okay. It's an integrated report.
Well, let's move on from this question. We obviously, there's a lot of information out there. This one is actually for State and BLM gentlemen, and this one was actually asked several times in the questions. So have you, has this, I'm assuming this question is meant for Alaska. Has there ever, have you ever not permitted a mine, BLM or State, or when was the last time there was a mine shut down for regulatory reasons, or has there been a mine shut down in Alaska recently for regulatory reasons?
I don't think so.
On either count, for either not permitting one or shutting one down?
Just a second.
Sure.
The way no occurs is typically because the company is typically paying for the process. No occurs. I'm sorry.
And what's your name?
My name is Bob Leffler. No occurs usually when the company sees they won't get a mine or won't get the permits that they think are appropriate. The process just stops.
Well, and so let me take it.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
No, then I'll see.
So the question is, do we ever say no? The basic answer to that is, yes, we say no all the time, but not in a way that I think the person is meaning the question. I think the question is meaning, do we ever deny a permit to mine? And as you should see from my one slide, there's not a single permit to mine. So there's not a single permit to say no to. And so then I guess the logical extension of that question is, do you ever say no to any of the permits? And we don't really say no to the permits, but we do say no throughout the process of permitting. And what I mean by that is the plan of operations and the applications that come into the agencies, and there's a host of state agencies, and I'll just talk about state process here. Okay. That what gets approved never looks like what gets proposed. And so that is demonstrates the process of us saying, no, we don't like this that you've proposed. Let's work together with you to redesign that aspect of the project. And so that we go through that process with the applicant. We also go through that process with the public. So in our public notices for those individual permits, we collect public comment, and we respond to those comments sometimes, occasionally, most of the time, I don't know what to say there, by requiring either changes in the project design or conditions to its approval. And so that's how I would answer that. More broadly than just permitting, this is another way I would answer that question, is that the executive branch agencies, so going back to Civics 101, we have the executive branch, the judicial branch, and the legislative branch. Legislative branch, Alaska State Legislature, they make our laws, our policies. The executive branch only has the authority to fully execute those laws, okay? And so when you're talking about mining, the mine companies are smart. They have quality people that they employ. They're not typically going to put forward a proposal that violates state law. And so from the get-go, we're looking at a proposal in the context of complying with state law. Okay. And if it does, we have to implement that law. If it complies, we have to say yes to that with conditions. And so then going on, be real quick on that, the legislature also, through its legislative actions, can designate withdrawal areas, so conservation areas, special use areas. The Alaska legislature has the authority to take lands off the table so mining and exploration activity cannot occur there. That also is a no that's legislated, okay? And there's a public process for that. They're your elected officials, my elected officials too. And then at the executive branch level, again, the administrative process, the agencies can do through mineral closure orders. So the Department of Natural Resources can put an area off limits to mining exploration through an administrative process. That also is a no. You can't mine in that area.
Okay, great. Anybody else? I think that pretty much covered it.
So for the federal process and the Bureau of Land Management, we're very, James Whitlock again with the BLM, very similar to the state in their process. Because of the mining law, and like John was explaining, you have a right. It's a mineral right. It's real estate property. You own that mineral. So the BLM doesn't have the authority to say you're not allowed to have your mineral. What we do have the authority to say is how you're going to access that via the surface use. And so through that process, you know, you submit a mine plan or whatever's going through that process, we review it, and if it doesn't work, we may say, you know, this plan isn't going to prevent unnecessary non-due degradation of the environment. It needs to be changed, and we'll work through that process. And that's really what the NEPA process is. That's what the mine plan modification process is. You identify where there's failures, where this is not going to work because it causes environmental degradation. You need to do this instead, and you move through that process. But we do have, to a degree, where you can say no, and that's when you have withdrawals. And that's the Secretary of the Interior would withdraw an area and close it to mineral entry. And then, of course, you can't go in there and stake a mining claim. You can't develop the resource. So there's, you know, of course, on those fronts. Do you have anything, John?
No, that's pretty much it. It's, you know, when we they said no in all the parklands, refuges, and actually the vast majority of BLM is withdrawn from mineral entry. And then, as you know, BLM Alaska is the vast majority placer mining operations in the interior. And, yeah, frequently someone proposes a mining operation technique that would cause unnecessary and undue degradation, and we say you have to do something different. And there's a small number of operators that aren't meeting their approved plans, and then, yeah, their plan is revoked, and they basically, their only option at that point is to do reclamation and shut down.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I have one more regulatory question, and then I think some of these questions will be for David and Guy and Bob. But another point on regulatory, can you address how community concerns are involved in making decisions about permitting, and any specific examples you've had of community, how community feedback and community involvement has either changed a decision or affected a decision or you know, made an impact in decisions of permitting on the state or federal level? I think they're just trying to get an example of why does the community input matter, or how do you take it into consideration?
Right, and it does. And it's obviously the federal government, we're required to involve the public throughout a whole process. And I can tell you, you know, one major concern in Alaska is subsistence use. And we really value that. In fact, you know, the BLM does a lot of planning efforts where we're out in communities trying to work with the communities to find out what's going on the ground. What do we need to know from the communities? And we take that information back, and it really drives a lot of our decision process. You know, knowing what's on the ground, what the community is concerned about, is a major part of, you know, this is your public lands. So how are we going to manage your public lands in our process? So we do take a lot of consideration in there. We try to get out in the communities and communicate with communities within the area and the region. And I know that the state has a very similar process.
Do you want me to spend more time on that one?
One of the questions was, can you think of any specific instances of when a public comment or a piece of public testimony has either given you new information that you've examined or taken into a different light in some way in the permitting process? I think they're looking specifically at how should they frame public comments?
As an example, Kensington Mine, I think, provides a good example. They were initially proposing a dry stack tail, and public comment about the visual effects of that in Lynn Canal were a leading reason why it was changed to a subaqueous disposal plan in Lower Slate Lake.
Okay, great. Okay, so specific. Next, we have a lot of questions about bonds, and I don't know who the best person is bonding and financial bonds and financial responsibilities. I think in one of the basic questions was, can someone please talk about bonds, how the amount is determined? And then there's some questions about when are bonds go into effect, like at the end of the life of a mine, during a disaster. And then there's a question about, is the community ever on foot the bill for some of these things? So if we could just start with a basic concept of what the bond is.
I'll start with the basic.
Kyle? David, do you have some information?
Yeah, I think that there's some good expertise on the panel that can speak to it too, but very basic. Bonding, financial assurance, has to be established or provided prior to development of the mine. So that is the timing sequence. It also has to be maintained throughout the operation of the mine. It usually where you get to closure is where and closure is where reclamation is really going strong, and you start to see the financial assurance reduced as concurrent reclamation is done, and you start to get a lot of concurrent reclamation at closure. There could be bonding that still is required in the post-closure monitoring period, which usually lasts 30 years as standard, if there's perpetual water treatment or other long-term care and maintenance needs. Bonding can be required as long as there's a disturbance or facilities that would need to be deconstructed at some point in the future.
And how is the amount determined?
The amount is determined first by the project proponent. The mining company will estimate the costs for closing and reclaiming the site. That gets submitted to the state agencies. DNR and DEC are the lead on that, and then there's the federal agency if there's a federal if it's on federal land that gets involved in that. And part of my job is to work among those three branches of agencies to review those cost estimates. The agencies go back and forth with the project proponent over what is reasonable and foreseeable. They come to the agencies, set the cost. And then that's the cost that's required after a public notice and comment period. That's the cost that gets set, and then the mining company has to provide one of the several approved financial assurance mechanisms. I don't know if I know them all off the top of my head, but we'll take gold, we'll take cash. We like those things. We'll also take letters of credit, surety bonds, and we also have a trust fund mechanism available in statute.
Okay.
I could go just a little bit further in defining how you get there. And one thing I like to tell miners when I'm working with them is imagine you write your reclamation plan as a scope of work. That reclamation plan defines what the land status is going to look like, what the land's going to look like when you're done mining, and what is it going to cost to do that work. So that's where a reclamation cost estimate is looking at. What is it actually going to work cost to do the work? So you're looking at labor, you're looking at equipment, fuel, oil, all those things that go into rental fees for vehicles and dozers, all that kind of stuff. That's really what goes into a reclamation cost estimate. All that is broken down. Labor rates, for the federal government, for the Bureau of Land Management, we require that labor rates be Davis-Bacon wages. So there's very specific criteria on how that's determined. The reclamation plan and the reclamation cost estimate need to match up. That process needs to match up so that when you can't complete reclamation, the agencies has the opportunity to go on the ground and implement your reclamation plan using the money you've provided in that bonding mechanism.
Okay. David, did you have some points? And then also just the question of if bonding covers catastrophic disaster with a mine.
So this is an issue that I've looked at for quite a few years, and I'd like to talk just briefly about some recommendations that I would make that I think would make the process better. Bonding mechanisms, actually one of them that wasn't mentioned that's available to the state is a corporate guarantee. Now, the state of Alaska has not, thankfully, chosen to implement that, but that's basically a letter from the mining company that says, I promise to pay. I think all of us can see that that's problematic, and I just that's a legislative mechanism. It also is a mechanism that's not allowed at the federal level, but it is at the state level. So
it requires regs.
Right.
It's not allowed. Right now, it's not usable.
Right. In terms of calculating the bond, I would actually like to see both federal and state regulators go out and hire a mining engineering company to do that, because that's what the companies do. Expertise at the agency level is stretched very thin. If you hire an engineering firm to do that, they put their reputation on the line coming up with that number. That also becomes a number that I get to look at as a member of the public. Quite frankly, when the calculations are done internally, politics can come into play. And believe me, there's a lot of pressure from companies to keep the bond as low as possible. And I've seen that happen. And I don't think agencies need to face that sort of pressure. So I'd be much more comfortable leaving it to an engineering company who has much more capability, quite frankly, than the agencies do. Let's let them put their reputation on the line for a number and then argue about that. And then finally, you know, what does this thing cover? It covers, hopefully, reclamation, closure, and post-closure activities. But the way I'd like to describe all of those things are reasonably foreseeable circumstance. It does not cover a tailings dam failure. There's no financial mechanism to cover tailings dam failures. So if a tailings dam fails, then if the company can't pay for it itself, then the public is on the hook for the money.
The public, I mean, what if it's on state property? I mean, I'm just trying to get an example.
It doesn't matter. Public or, you know, federal or state, you know, whoever's...
Right.
I mean, for instance, in Montana, one of the mines I work at is one of the very early heap leach gold mines, Ortman Landusky, and we had a company go bankrupt there. There was not enough money in the fund as it was established to pay for long-term, for perpetual water treatment there. But that's a burden that both the state of Montana and the Bureau of Land Management are sharing, so it doesn't really fall up on all of them.
Okay. Kyle, and then Bob, did you want to make a point too? No, you're just looking. Okay, Kyle.
Yeah, so Alaska Department of Natural Resources under state statute, state law, has authority for regulating reclamation, mine reclamation, regardless of land ownership. So what Dave's saying is correct there. And then also the other point I wanted to make was there's a reclamation policy of the state that's in statute as well, but just for this meeting today, I think it's important to say what reclamation is. Reclamation and restoration are two completely different concepts. Reclamation under state statute means, I'm paraphrasing here, but it means to stabilize the land conducive for future uses. So when you're talking about reclamation, you're talking about earthwork, regrading to a stable slope, seeding to stabilize against erosion, and then you're also considering what are the future possible or potential uses of that area and making sure that it's in a usable condition for those future uses. So that's reclamation in a nutshell.
Okay, reclamation. And David, what you were saying about catastrophic, so bonding won't cover that, or anybody on the panel. What about bankruptcy? You mentioned bankruptcy quickly.
Yeah, bankruptcy should be taken care of by that reclamation and closure bond.
Okay.
In other words, at any point, there should be enough money available at any point in a mine's life to close it down.
Okay.
If the company has to walk.
Okay.
Also,
okay.
I just want to point out that the reclamation, that your bond is not static. It's reviewed. The state has a cycle. The BLM has a cycle. They're reviewed. They're changed, modified, because they have to account for the CPI.
Those CPI?
Inflation, sorry. They have to account for inflation. So anyway, it does change. You know, you'll see some mines go from $3 million to $8 million in 1 year just because something's changed. They've modified the mine. Whatever. So they do change. Also.
Okay. That was a question, too. If a mine expands, does the bond expand with it? Okay.
And the bond will always be for the maximum authorized disturbance over that permit cycle, which is 5 years.
Okay, complicated issue, but there was a lot of questions on that one. Guy, we haven't heard from you in a few. Maybe I'll throw this one at you because it's kind of esoteric a little, but philosophical. What would the perfect safe mine look like, and is it possible?
Oh, boy.
I mean, it's a very, I know, but I thought I'd get you back in the game.
Well, speaking in terms of large mines.
Okay, large mines,
you know,
yeah.
Large mines. The perfect safe mine would be a mine that could operate sustainably, safely, protect all the values, add value to the community, create community stability, you know, rather than divisiveness, not create a hierarchy of incomes within a community. It's very, obviously very difficult. And it would be a mine that is in it for the long term, not to come in, make as much money as possible in 20 years, and then get out. And whose main goal is to get shareholders the maximum amount of profit for their investment. It would be a multi-generational, hopefully family-owned, you know, responsible mine operated by people with skin in the game.
Okay. All right. Well, I know there's a lot of different answers to that question, but David.
I might just add that I've been involved with the process now for 7 years to develop on an international basis a set of standards for responsible mining, which sort of gets at this question. I mean, obviously, each individual is going to view whether a mine's responsible or not, or successful or not, you know, in your own eyes. But the thing that makes this effort different is this is the first multi-party effort to do this. That is, mining companies are involved. Communities are involved, NGOs are involved, and downstream users of mining projects or products like metal users, copper, or jewelry folks are all involved with this. Every set of standards that tries to do this now were developed unilaterally, basically, so everybody has their own idea of what that should be. The risks for NGOs and communities are, well, now we've got a set of standards, and if a mine meets them, it's a good mine. And there is always going to be some people who say there is no such thing. So, but that's a risk that these communities take. The risk for the mining community is, well, we've got this tough set of standards now to be certified under this process, kind of like the Forest Stewardship Council. Do we really want to spend the money it would take to come up to those standards? And the risk for the downstream users are that the previous two sets of parties don't come to agreement and they have pickets out on their front steps. So that's why they're interested in that.
Okay, thank you. All right, interesting question. This one, I'm not sure if anybody can actually answer it, but I'm going to throw it out there because it's very local is what I'm trying to get at is, what impact or influence does the application for Tier 3 classification of the Chilkat River have on how you would evaluate or how a permit application would be evaluated and the classification if granted? So I believe the Chilkat Indian Village recently applied or is recommending that the Chilkat be classified Tier 3. Is that wild? And Outstanding natural resource water, I believe, if anybody. Okay. So they've made that recommendation, the Indian Village, and I'm just this question is wondering what effect would that classification have? Does anybody know? Guy. Okay.
I'll take a crack at it.
Okay.
So kind of under the Federal Clean Water Act, there's three classifications of water bodies for most states. Some states have four. You have a Tier 1 water body that is already impaired by, you know, it could be just a single pollutant, and it'll be put under restrictions, discharge limitations for that pollutant. By impaired, what I mean is it doesn't meet the criteria for the designated use. If the designated use is drinking water, aquatic life, agricultural water, there's a certain set of numeric, generally, and sometimes narrative criteria. Like a numeric criteria would be 3.4 parts per billion of copper. A narrative criteria would be an oily sheen. Can't have those things. The next segment of water is considered a tier two water body. And that's a water body where the quality in the water is much higher than what is needed to designate those uses. It's way above the criteria. It's better water. Those are the waters that are generally subject to degradation. So basically you have what's called an assimilative capacity. You have a capacity within that water body to absorb those pollutants to a certain point before they get to the criteria or below the criteria. So for most discharges, they're allowed only in a tier two or a high quality water. Under anti-degradation, which the state adopted some 29 years ago, there's a tier three water body, which is an outstanding national resource water. That is a water body, and the state, let me back up, the state has not set guidelines or criteria or a mechanism yet for determining tier three water bodies. And actually don't even have a real mechanism for determining tier two water bodies. They look around, and if it's not an impaired water body, they assume that it's a tier two water body. Anyways, and a water tier three water body is a water body of such outstanding qualities, and it doesn't have to even be water quality. It could be fish and wildlife, habitat qualities, medicinal plant qualities, as New Mexico's is, other things like that. And if it is designated as such, whether it's an administrative process through DEC, DNR, or it's a legislative process, we don't know yet, there can be no degradation to that water body. Does that mean there can be no discharge to it? No, not necessarily. In almost every state, and it's left up to the states, they will allow temporary and short-term degradation, like if you need to build a bridge across it. They'll allow temporary degradation for restoration work, if there needs to be some restoration done in that water body. And in some states, they will allow discharge into the water body as long as it meets or is better than the water quality criteria. You're not adding pollutants to the water. One other point, tier three water bodies also subject the tributaries to that water body under the no degradation. Because obviously, if you dump something upstream in a tributary, it's going to degrade downstream. So it does cover the tributaries as well. So I hope that answered the question.
I think that was pretty thorough. Anybody want to follow up with that? Are there any tier threes in Alaska?
No, there's not. There's been some nominated, but they've been rejected.
Okay, so it is a process that has to be determined by...
They basically are rejected because there is no mechanism to determine them.
Okay, it? Interesting. All right.
Margaret?
Yes, go ahead, Kyle.
I was just going to say the Alaska Department of Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation has a pretty good website on anti-degradation and the process and where it's at for the tier three designation regulations. So that went through public comment last year, and the agency is still working on finalizing the regulations and that process. And they've got a great website. I have it here. If anyone's interested, just ask me afterwards.
It's a workshop.
Okay, great. Okay. Oh, Guy?
DEC is going to put on a workshop up in Anchorage sometime in May. Oh, okay, is there? All right. And they're going to go over the comments they received for the first draft and where they go from here.
Okay, thank you.